WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. And we're going to start this edition with a special guest. Evan's dad joined us on the show this week.
Yeah, we had a conversation about him getting older and his struggle to still feel relevant. And the clip you're about to hear with my dad is just part of what became a really lively and interesting hour with a range of panelists. They talked about how they handle retirement and feeling like the world might not need or value them anymore. My father was blunt about how it's hitting him. He's 73. He was forced, because of work rules, into retirement at the start of this year. He wanted to keep working, but he can't, at least not in his job that he had for about 40 years. And here's why he says it's been so hard.
It was probably, initially, it was just too much of an ego shot. It was feeling I'd lost my sense of being relevant. And I woke up on January 2nd, and I realized for the first time since really college, I had no place to go. And that was not a comforting feeling. A lot of my friends who had retired earlier than I did told me how much they love retirement, and you're going to love retirement. And I woke up thinking, what am I going to do today? Where should I go? What should I do? And it was discomforting.
Did you talk to your friends who are enjoying it? Did you try to figure out why they are liking it so much and you are not?
Oh, they tell me all the time. I don't have to ask them anything. You know, they it sounds like it's they're trying to convince themselves sometimes. They're telling me how much they enjoy retirement.
You don't buy it?
Well, I have experienced nothing so far that buys it, I'll say that. It's only been 3 months.
But there's this idea that retirement brings autonomy. It brings endless choices that you didn't have before.
That's really not true. That's really not true. You always have choices. It's a question of what you do with your time. Even when you're working, you always have time for choices. Now, all of a sudden, you're overwhelmed with time. And that's something you have to get used to.
I think I have a hard time fully getting my head around some of what you have told me, which we're going to get into in a second, for two reasons. Number one, it's because I'm younger. I'm not near retirement at all. And so it's hard to grapple with the emotions I may have if I ever get there. But it's also because, you know, you're my dad and you are the person who was always hyper relevant to me for counsel, ideas, answers, and everyone around you, I thought, looked at you the same way. And yet what you're telling me is that you not only didn't really want to retire, but you were worried about relevance. The word relevance stayed with me. I mean, what is the concern about relevance to you?
The other half of that coin is when you retire, you realize you're getting old. And old brings with it any number of things, none of which are necessarily attractive. And when you're working and when you have a job with responsibilities, and it doesn't matter at what level, somebody is always going to be relying on you for something. And it probably is unconscious, but it gives you satisfaction to know that you have fulfilled that need that someone else has. And now you are out on an island and nobody's calling, nobody's knocking on the door. Friends do, but nobody is saying, hey, I need your help on this. What do you think about that? How should I do this? You're simply not relevant.
Do you really feel that way, though? I mean, I understand, I guess, the construct you're giving me, but do you truly feel less relevant or not relevant?
Yes, I truly feel that way.
The entire hour was compelling and honest, and I recommend checking it out at wxxinews.org/connections.
Next, a songwriter who is using her music to help veterans, but she says she might be an unlikely voice in this regard. Mary Gaucher calls herself a leftist lesbian musician, and she grew up with a preconceived notion of who serves in the military. But Gaucher was invited to spend weekends with veterans, getting to know them and asking the vets to co-write songs with her.
The result is an album called Rifles and Rosary Beads. She came to Rochester to perform at the Love and Cup, but first she joined us to explain how the project came together.
I was asked to do a retreat with veterans and co-write songs with them about 5 years ago. The way it works is there's four professional songwriters, 8 to 10 veterans, and we go to a retreat center. We show up on a Friday, and we write songs till Sunday afternoon, and by Sunday afternoon, we've got a dozen songs that didn't exist on Friday. We play the songs at a little concert at the end of the retreat. The songs are composed of the words that the veterans tell us. We listen to their stories. We sit one-on-one into a small little room somewhere on the campus of a retreat center and bear witness and turn the story that we're being told into songs. And the challenge is to bear witness in non-judgment, no matter what is said, to just mirror back what we hear and not in any way get into a discussion of morality or judgment. And we don't diagnose. We're not therapists. We don't sit in a position of authority. We're just songwriters who want to get a great song. And so we tell their story in the song. And their experience is sometimes deeply emotional. These stories are difficult. Our veterans are struggling. We've been at war 17 years, and civilians are very removed from the experience of military families now. There's a great divide. They feel unseen and unheard. And we have also this picture of a soldier as someone who doesn't talk. Like, soldiers don't talk about what they've been through. But it turns out they do if they're listened to in non-judgment by a songwriter anyway. We have had soldiers talk and talk and talk, and we're able to transcribe what they say and translate it and put it into a song, kind of, I call it midwifing. We didn't create the baby, but that baby's already in the birth canal, and we just help it bring it into the world, and that baby is what their soul needs to say.
Is there one you want to start with? You want to play a...
Yeah, I will. I wrote this with a young man who served in Desert Storm. He talked about the experience of Veterans Day and how he has so many mixed emotions about it. And we got into this is a story song. We got into this story because he told me that on Veterans Day in the South, there's I guess everybody knows now because of the shooting in Nashville at the Waffle House, but there's a chain of breakfast places called Waffle House. And if you have an active duty military ID, they give you free breakfast at the Waffle House. And Waffle House is a Southern institution. So I said, well, let's just put you at the Waffle House on Veterans Day and let's make up a song about how you feel sitting there. And so that's what we did. And this is called Bullet Holes in the Sky. It's the 11th of November in Nashville, Tennessee. Free breakfast at the Waffle House if I show my ID. A parade up on the riverfront, you can hear trumpets play. Hands on hearts, the color guard kicks it off on Veterans Day, and they thank me for my service and wave those little flags. They genuflect on Sundays, and yes, they'd send us back, but I believe in God and country, and in the angels up on high, and in heaven shining down on us through bullet holes in the sky.
That's Mary Gauchet. You can find a lot more of her online. Let's turn now to a discussion on race. You might have heard that earlier this month at a Starbucks in Philadelphia, two black men were arrested for loitering. They were waiting for a third person to arrive, and they had not ordered drinks yet, so the manager called police. Starbucks' CEO says it was a painful mistake, and the company will now require anti-racism education for employees.
Our panelists describe their own experiences in similar situations. Here's Shawanda McGee, a program coordinator for teen empowerment in Rochester.
Shutting down Starbucks for a day, it's bigger than that. It's a lot bigger than that. I believe if the CEO was really in it and really cares, then he has the platform. He has the ability to take his platform and make it bigger than just we're going to shut down and do some racial work. Where, no, I can, as the CEO of Starbucks, I can do some racial work in the world, not just in my coffee shops.
Absolutely.
Because yeah. Starbucks isn't very welcoming to black and brown people across America anyways. It feels very uncomfortable as a black and brown person to walk in a Starbucks. The environment isn't welcoming to black and brown people at all.
For our white listeners who want to understand more about why. You say the environment doesn't feel welcoming. Why would you say that?
You walk in, you're looked at confused as to, like, why would you even, mm-hmm. what are you coming to get from Starbucks? Like, what do you even...
How can you afford it?
Yeah, like, can you afford to even drink coffee from Starbucks? Like, Dunkin' Donuts is, like, the black and brown people version of Starbucks. Like, that's how we're treated. Like, you walk in Starbucks, people always look at me like, and... No one ever writes my name on my Starbucks cup because no one ever asks how do you spell it? Or, you know, no one, I say my name's Shawanda and then they say, okay. But my name's never on the cup, but I see Katie's name on the cup and I'm like, well, why isn't my name? Or my name's not screamed out, my order's screamed out when I get Starbucks.
Next, a discussion about what might threaten the survival of the human race. We marked 100 years since the Spanish flu pandemic devastated the globe, and we asked doctors and researchers, could it happen again?
Their answer was a unanimous yes, and it will, at least in some form. And when a listener emailed to say that he thought terrorists would pose a bigger threat in using biological agents, here's what researcher Dave Topham had to say.
Mother Nature is by far the worst bioterrorist. If we haven't learned that already, I don't think man can create anything that's more deadly than what Mother Nature has been throwing around.
Even in the future?
Even in the future. You know, the response would be the same. I mean, and the 1918 virus is a good example. I don't think we could design a virus that's more deadly than that. It's got so many different features that convey pathogenicity. It's remarkable. It's a... You know, most pandemics that have emerged since have been milder. You know, 1918 really was something special.
Okay. Dr. Bennett, I saw you all nodding. Do you agree? What would you tell Adam, who thought, boy, I thought this would have to be a weaponized form to really threaten a big part of the world population?
I agree that Mother Nature does a really good job of this, that we don't even need to think about a weaponized form. But obviously, that's always been a fear as well, that somehow someone will weaponize one of these viruses. But I think that the more concerning thing is just the fact that in nature, these viruses not only spread easily, but they also mutate fairly easily. And so we see new forms all the time. We see, you know, a virus that we think is fairly benign that suddenly becomes worse. We also see variability in just the extent to which it spreads or the effectiveness of the vaccine. And this year was a great example of a year when we saw more cases of influenza and more hospitalizations than we've ever seen in the last 10 years. And it was not because it was a new virus, and it was not because the experts chose the wrong strain. It had to do with the manufacturing of the vaccine and the fact that it ended up being less effective.
Universal vaccine? Dave, I know there's been a lot of work on this here. What would you tell the audience about, first of all, so-called universal flu vaccine?
Yeah, so there's a strong effort underway. In fact, there's a new strategic plan at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease for the field as a whole to develop a universal flu vaccine. You're going to see a lot of new funding shift in that direction. We are involved in that work. In fact, we've been doing that work for many years, trying to understand how people respond differently to influenza and looking for those parts of the immune response that are shared among many viruses. So there are many different technologies that could be used and tested to make a universal flu vaccine. One hasn't emerged yet as the sort of favorite approach. We've done some work looking at what would happen to a virus if you had universal immunity and you applied that to the virus. Could the virus mutate those conserved regions? And the answer is yes. As soon as you put a virus under pressure, any part of the virus, it will mutate and change.
What happens then?
Well, then you lose that immunity. So even a universal flu vaccine targeting conserved epitopes will, you know, eventually have to be updated. What we did learn, though,
I'm sorry to say, it sounds to me like there is no such thing as a universal flu vaccine now.
You know, I don't want to go that far. What we did learn is that it takes much, much longer for the virus to mutate those regions.
Okay.
So it's a much less efficient process than with the seasonal strains. But the point was that it can happen. So we you know, eyes wide open, we need to be aware that these things are possible so that when we're designing a better vaccine, we take that into account.
So if, let's say, sometime in the future, we get a so-called universal flu vaccine, we would expect it to be, I think what we have to understand the caveat is it's going to be a temporarily universal vaccine until we see a mutation. Mm-hmm. But a mutation should happen in a year, in 5, in 10, in 50?
So the goal is protecting 75% of the population for 5 years.
Okay.
That's what we're shooting for. And I think, you know, that is attainable. The question is, you know, what are the costs going to be in terms of, you know, side effects or whatnot? I think there's... We have a ways to go. It's going to be a while before we have a universal vaccine.
Are we talking, do we use the word universal because it sells better than lots better flu vaccine, you know?
Yes, that's, I think, a big part of it. It's simple for people to understand.
But universal does sound like 100%. What you're saying is 75.
Yep.
Okay.
So
it's important.
I would be happy with an improved seasonal vaccine.
Okay.
I think there's, in fact, I know there's lots of things we could do with the existing vaccine technology to produce more broad and cross-reactive immunity. It wouldn't be universal, but those vaccines are much closer. You know, we just have to change up a little bit what we do with existing technology, and I think we can do a better job.
Finally, a discussion about religion and misogyny. We previewed the upcoming World Parliament of Religions in Toronto, which will focus on the need for inclusion. Our panelists discussed the history of misogyny in religious texts.
A listener named Mary wrote to say that she was comfortable with the biblical separation of gender roles. Here's the response from Sister Susan Nowak, a professor of religion at Nazareth College.
Oh, I can more than understand what she is saying, and I think in a particular way, the message and the crafting of the Christian message and the practices has been very difficult for women in particular. Mm. That there have been times, more than times, where the Christian message has been a conveyor of the fact that the female's body, sexuality, is a negative thing, a temptation, the identification of the introduction of temptation with Eve and the way that that has carried out in very real ways for women's lives. I think that has to be addressed and not backed away from. I think the discounting of women and their intellect has been something that's part and parcel of religions and not just Christianity, but most definitely there. My difference is probably with Kitty is the fact that I see that as when religion has allowed itself to adapt to a cultural message that is not really at the core of the tradition. And so I don't see Jesus of Nazareth as someone who was pointing out anyone in the crowd as less than and not worthy of. But I do see plenty of times when the church institution in its teaching and its interpretation of its teachings has done that and truly needs to repent.
But sister, if what you're saying is correct, that there is a tradition in many religions, not just Christianity, that we can find what those some would call misogyny.
Oh, yes.
Okay?
Yes.
Then why are you a Christian?
Why am I a
Christian? Is that an unfair question?
No, it's not an unfair question. It is a life question. And so you've put me right on the spot in terms of that life question. And for me, it is because I find in the midst not only the message of Jesus of Nazareth, but in my community and in different traditions, the quest is for being a human fully alive. Evan, there's no place I can go as a woman where I am not going to come up against misogyny, where I am not going to run head-on into patriarchy, where I am not going to find that I am devalued in many, many ways simply because of being born a woman. I have to find the place where I think in some ways I can best do battle. And I find in the healing message of Jesus of Nazareth, I hear, you know, in the covenantal message through Judaism, in the covenantal message through Islam, I find it in Buddhism. I find that there is a core there that calls for the religions to critique themselves and to promote humans fully alive, and I take that on as my message.
Sister, you just played the trump card in the argument against religion based on misogynistic terms, because that kind of, and I had a friend make the same argument the other day, and it was like I could finally see a little more clearly and understand better, because if you look at it in a vacuum, it makes the assumption that, well, if you just leave a religious structure, that you won't find misogyny, you won't find patriarchy. That's very disarming when you do that. I just want to warn you. That's very effective. It's very effective. It's such a good point, and it's a really and I appreciate you answering the question, because I know it was a direct one, but I think Kitty's phone call leads us to ask these questions. It's important. And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370. It's 1370. It is. WRUR 88.5 FM. You'd think if I don't have the script in front of me, I can't even remember anything. You're going to challenge me to do the rest?
You're improvising. Go ahead.
It's WEOS. 89.5 FM, WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, and the WXXI mobile app. Megan Mack, Evan Dawson.
See you Monday. Smooth, Evan Dawson. Smooth.
I am smooth like sandpaper.